Angeles Times. He provided his answer: yes, it is an obstacle to real Mideast peace. McCloskey cited the risk of nuclear confrontation in the Middle East and the fundamental differences between the interests of Israel and the U.S. He observed that members of the Jewish community demand that Congress support Israel in spite of these differences. This demand, he argued, coupled with the weakness of Congress in the face of any such force, can prevent the president, in his hour of both crisis and opportunity, from having the flexibility necessary to achieve lasting Israeli-Palestinian peace. Emphasis supplied, on the next election day, all three of McCloskey's opponents received Jewish financial support. Stephen S. Rosenfeld, deputy editorial page editor of The Washington Post, drew a definite conclusion. Jewish political participation defeated McCloskey's Ed McCloskey's troubles, however, were not over. A tracking system initiated by the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, of Naboth assured that McCloskey would have no peace, even as a private citizen. The group distributed a memorandum containing details of his actions and speeches to its chapters around the country. According to the memo, it was designed to assist local ADL groups with counteraction guidance whenever McCloskey appeared in public. Trouble followed him even on the campus. McCloskey accepted an invitation from the Student Governing Council of Stanford University to teach a course on Congress at Stanford. Howard Goldberg, a council member and also director of the Hillel Center, the campus Jewish club, told the group that inviting McCloskey was a slap in the face of the Jewish community. The quintessential lobbyist Stephen Salaz, a highly visible congressman who represents a heavily Jewish district in Brooklyn, prides himself on accomplishing many good things for Israel. Since his first election in 1974, Salaz established a reputation as an intelligent, widely traveled, aggressive legislator, totally committed to Israel's interests. In a December 1980 newsletter to his constituents, he provided an unprecedented insight into how Israel, despite the budgetary restraints under which the U.S. government labors, is able to get ever-increasing aid. Early that year, he had started his own quest for increased aid. He reported that he persuaded Secretary of State Cyrus Vance to come to his Capitol Hill office to talk it over. There he threatened Vance with a fight for the increase on the House floor if the administration opposed it in committee. Shortly thereafter, he said Vance sent word that the administration would recommend an increase $200 million extra in military aid, although not as his next goal was to convince the Foreign Affairs Committee to increase the administration's levels. Salaz felt an increase approved by the committee could be sustained on the House floor. He was right. Salaz summed it up in his letter as follows: Israel, as a result, will soon be receiving a total of $660 million more in military and economic aid than it received from the U.S. government last year. Through a combination of persistence and persuasion, we were able to provide Israel with an increase in military economic aid in 1 year alone, which is the equivalent of almost 3 years of contributions by the National UJA, United Jewish Appeal, emphasis supplied. In his newsletter, Salaz explained to his constituents that he had sought membership on the Foreign Affairs Committee because I wanted to be in. Proof of his dedication was evidenced in September 1984 when, as a member of the House-Senate Conference on Export Administration Act Amendments, he demanded in a public meeting to know the legislation's implications for Israel. He asked Congressman Howard Wolp, "Is there anything that the Israelis want from us, or could conceivably want from us, that they weren't able to get?" Even when Wolp responded with a clear no, Salaz pressed, "Have you spoken to the Israeli embassy?" Wolp responded, "I personally have not," he admitted, "but my office has." Then Salaz tried again, "You are giving me an absolute assurance that they, the Israelis, have no reservation at all about this?" Finally convinced that Israel was content with the legislation, Salaz relaxed. "If they have no problem with it, then there is no reason for us to," he said. To put this in perspective, if the 80 or more military bases and installations around the country, which Congress is in the process of closing for economic reasons, are in fact closed, the estimated annual savings of $600 million is less than the increase arranged by Congressman Solars in military and economic aid to Israel in 1980. Adjusted for inflation, the increase in Israel aid is almost twice as much. A veteran Ohio congressman observes, when Solars and others press for more money for Israel, nobody wants to say no. You don't need many examples of intimidation for politicians to realize what the potential is. The Jewish lobby is terrific. Anything it wants, it gets. Jews are educated, often have a lot of money, and vote on the basis of a single issue: Israel. They are unique in that respect. Emphasis supplied. Congressman Dimelly's dilemma. Democratic Congressman Mervyn W. Dimelly, former Lieutenant Governor of California, came to Washington in 1980 with perfect credentials as a supporter of Israel. In his successful campaign for Lieutenant Governor, he spoke up for Israel in all the statewide Democratic canvasses. He co-founded the Black Americans in Support of Israel Committee, organized pro-Israel advertising in California newspapers, and helped to rally other black officials to the cause. In Congress, as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, he became a dependable vote for Israeli interests. Nevertheless, in 1982, the pro-Israeli community withdrew its financial support, and the following year the AIPAC organization in California marked him for defeat and began seeking a credible opponent to run against him in 1984. Explaining this sudden turn of events, Dimelly cites two black marks against his pro-Israeli record in Congress. First, he occasionally asked challenging questions about aid to Israel in committee. Although his questions were mild and infrequent, he stood out because no one else was even that daring. Second, far more damning in the eyes of the AIPAC, he met twice with PLO leader Yasser Arafat. Both meetings were unplanned and of no international significance. Nevertheless, it created an uproar in the Jewish community. Dimelly found intimidation everywhere. Whenever he complains, he says, he receives a prompt visit from an AIPAC lobbyist, usually accompanied by a Dimelly constituent. He met one day with a group of Jewish constituents, all of them old friends, and told them that, despite his grumbling, in the end he always voted pound D for aid to Israel. He said, "Not once, I told them, have I ever strayed from the course." One of his constituents spoke up and said, "That's not quite right. Once you abstained. They are that good," marveled Dimelly. The man was right. Dimelly considers membership on the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on the Middle East a no-win situation. He says of many of his Jewish critics in California, "What is tragic is that so many Jewish people misconstrue criticism of Israel as anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic." He speaks admiringly of the open criticism of Israeli policy that often occurs within Israel itself. "It is easier to criticize Israel in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, than it is in the US Congress, here in this land of free speech." Dimelly notes that 10 out of the 37 members of the Foreign Affairs Committee are Jewish and finds it so stacked there is no chance for constructive dialogue. He names Republican Congressman Ed Shore of California as the only member of the Subcommittee on Europe and the Middle East who even shadow boxes. At one hearing on economic aid to foreign countries, only Dimelly complained that aid to Israel was too high. "How can the United States afford to give so much money in view of our economic crisis to a country that has rejected the president's peace initiatives and stepped up its settlements in the occupied territories?" he demanded. The case of Congressman Ed Zschau at the same hearing, referred to by Congressman Dimelly, Ed Shaw, a freshman Republican from California, provided the only other break from the pro-Israel questioning. "Do you think," he asked, "there should be conditions on aid to Israel that might hasten the objectives of the peace process?" Getting no response, he pressed on, "Given that we are giving aid in order to achieve progress in peace in the area, wouldn't it make sense to associate with the aid some modest conditions like a halt in settlement policy?" He received no support on his questions. Although Congressman Shaw did not then know it, his political fate was sealed. In 1986, Representative Edwin Shaw was defeated for the Senate by Senator Alan Cranston, financed in part by AIPAC. According to a report in the June 24, 1987, edition of the Wall Street Journal, a key figure in Shaw's defeat may have been Michael Golland, a Los Angeles developer, who is one of the largest donors to AIPAC who has been active in a